Shoftim Perek Zion.
What?
Perek Zion. No, we haven't done Perek Zion. Okay. Ginon is in basically Emek Yisrael, around Afua, that area. And he's gathered an army. And it says, Vayashkem Yerubal Hu Gidon. Now, I'd just like to point out here, at the beginning of the parak, if you look at the way it's printed, it doesn't look like the beginning of the parak is where it says the beginning of the parak is. There's this open space, and then there's closed spaces. There's no pause between sentences. Does everybody know why that is? Does anybody know why that is? Is anybody awake today?
Yeah. Why the spaces are there?
Why the spaces are there and why it doesn't necessarily coincide.
What spaces?
Perek Sheva. The seventh Perek Sheva. The seventh Perek. You have the last Perek and Perek Vav. And immediately it's followed by the first Perek of the seventh Perek. Does everybody understand what I'm saying?
No.
Then you have after Pasuk Aleph, before Pasuk Beis, you have a big white space. And then after Pasuk Dalet, after Pasuk Gimel, before Pasuk Dalet, you have a big white space. What does that represent?
They're all over the place.
Time? White spaces is all over the place. What? It's a new paragraph. It represents an idea. Now, the question, there's two questions, and there's one question and one comment. Why would we start a chapter, a paragraph, where there is no open space, no beginning of a paragraph, no beginning of a new idea? A paragraph is a new idea. Why would we start that in this fashion?
The prakim are invention of
printers. The prakim are invented of printers, and what kind of printers?
Christian printers, right?
Christian printers, people that were not familiar with the tradition. And therefore, oftentimes, they would divide the parakim inappropriately or not according to the way we would divide them. That's one concept to know. The same is true of dividing. We have certain books that are divided into Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Beis. These are divisions that were useful for the printers. But what happened is that when the people were writing commentaries, in the Gemara, if you look at the way the commentary cites the Pasuk, it doesn't cite the whole Pasuk. And most often, when it's referring to something, it's at the end of the Pasuk, it won't even cite what it's referring to. It'll cite the beginning of the sentence and assume that the reader will know what it's referring to. But as the people got, it became more difficult, what happened is that people would cite something and they would cite it so that you could find it easily. And therefore they would cite it according to the notation that was established by the printers, by the parak, by the sentence in the parak. And that was how the parakim became divided. The white spaces are actually two different kinds of white spaces. One is in the Chumash, one has got a pay, and one has got a sign. Pay is patuch, it's open, and it's a white space of three letters. The other is closed, sagur, and it's a white space of nine letters. And it indicates that the idea has changed, or the idea is a continuation. It's a new component of it, but a continuation. Here, the perek, prakim, flow, it's all about Gidon. It's still a general flow about Gidon. It starts off that Yerubal, Gidon is called Yerubal because he's destroyed the Baal, idol. And he's fought with the Baal and he's brought the people back. And therefore the Navi wishes to emphasize that Gidon is Yerubal. He's fought with the idol worship, the concept of idol worship. And he goes down and he gathers an army. And he's camped on a mountain, and they're camped below. And again, the idea of going down to fight is an idea of indicating your belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and that you're willing to go out and fight. HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to him and says, you have too many people. You have too many soldiers. How many soldiers does Gidon have? What? He has 30,000. How many soldiers does the other side have? The Amalek, the Midianim, all of the other side. How many do they have? They have about 140,000. Kadosh Baruch Hu comes and says, you got too many soldiers. Why?
Because if they win, they want to make it look like it's actually...
Because two things. One is the nature of the period and the nature of the necessity that it be clearly a nace. The people, as we saw, when the Malach first came to Gidon said, Kadosh Baruch Hu saved us. He saved us from Egypt. He did this, da, 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 da. But he's not doing miracles for us now. And that was a general kind of attitude.
What were the numbers? 30,140?
About 140.
How is that not... I understand that's still logistically difficult. How is that
it's still logistically difficult, but you can say that you were saved by your fighting ability. Israel has done that many times.
It's like 4.5 times the size of the army.
Right.
Half
or something.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's not.
No doubt. It's a chance.
You can always say when you have so many soldiers, you can say, oh, "Our soldiers were better. Our soldiers were this. We had better tactics." If you look at what happens in Israel now, you know, the Arab armies and all the wars were vastly greater than the Israeli army. And the people, after 67, for example, when they came to the Kotel, the Israeli army clearly said, God helped us, this was miraculous. But that worked for one day. Because there was a whole army, and then they could say, well, yes, but it was our planning, or yes, it was because our soldiers were better equipped, are better motivated, are better fighters. So even though you have, they're only outnumber you by about 4-1, you could still make the argument. But we'll see that it gets down to Gidon having 300 people. And with the 300 people, he defeats them. Now, this is like the last of the open fighting. We'll see later on with Sancherev that towards, you know, many, many, many years later, about almost 450, 500 years later, Sancherev, who comes and attacks and destroys the 10 tribes and is attacking the kingdom of Judea, he is destroyed by a plague. But again, this is the last of the fighting that you have two forces. The small force miraculously wins. And Kodesh Baruch Hu says, we need to have this appear to be miraculous. Everybody should see this. So the first thing he does, he tells Gideon to do, is to do something. Now there's two types of wars in Halacha. Anybody have an idea what the two types would be?
God commanded and not? No?
We call one a Milchemet Mitzvah, and one is called a Milchemet Rishus. Both are God commanded. Or to fight a war, you have to have certain things. Milchemet Mitzvah is though when you are being attacked. And in that kind of war, everybody has to fight. In a Milchemet Rishus, in the Chumash, there is a order of how you do it. You go and you tell the soldiers, whoever has gotten married in the past year, whoever has built a new house in the past year, whoever has planted a new vineyard in the past year, and whoever's afraid, go home. Talk about why those are selected and those are mixed up with the whoever's afraid. But the people can go home at that point. After the people stay, you then set up the Kohen that's there, stands and says whoever leaves gets killed. But they can go home. In a Milchemet Mitzvah, that does not apply. This is a Milchemet Mitzvah. They are given the option of doing that. They're told whoever is afraid, and the others are left out, whoever is afraid, go home. How many people go home? 20,000.
Wow.
You're left with 10,000. Kodesh Baruch Hu says, still too many. And Kodesh Baruch Hu says, go down. We'll have a test. And he doesn't tell Gideon yet what the test is. He says, take them down to a little creek. This is Pesach time. There's not a lot of water. There could have been a lot of water, but maybe it was a year like this year with not too much rain. But there was more rain. There was some water. Take them down. And whoever goes down on their knees and scoops the water up to drink, there's one kind of person. Another person who's those people that flop down and drink with their tongue. They have to lap it up because the water does not go down the esophagus easily. That was another group. And what was the division of the two groups?
The ones who drink with like their hands went to the water.
What?
The ones who took the water went to work. And the others went home. No?
So the ones who lay down and did not kneel by the water were the ones who went to war.
Yeah, that's what
I said. Okay. The ones who kneeled down and picked up the water in their hands and drank from their hands were sent home.
I know, I said that was white.
Okay.
No, they're more like people on that side anymore.
Okay, because they didn't bow. The most of the portion talk about the fact that they did not bow. They were used to bowing down. There are two parts that they talk about. One is either they were used to bowing, or that they, when they bow down, they would see their image reflected. And it could be interpreted as if they were bowing. Those people, and again, the period was a period in which there was idol worship. So those people that were careful were the ones that were taken to go fight. And 300 people were left. There is a period in Jewish history called the Haskalah about 300 years ago. And if you look in the Chumash, you know, it says you have this thing and the people go home. And they had Well, you had a play to make fun of the religious. And it's important to understand some of the dynamics now. But in the play, they had these people that were going out to fight, and they had lots of people on stage, and then they said, who got married and who planted a vineyard and who built a house and who's afraid. The people kept going out, and finally there was this one old looking man that was left on stage. And they ended the play. So some of the people came to the rabbi of the city and said, we should do something against these people. They're making fun of Judaism. We should do something. This was in the earlier stages, the earlier period of the Haskalah. Later on, in many of the parts of Europe, the Haskalah became the leaders of the community. But the rabbi said, no, they're 100% right. This is what happens. But they didn't finish the play. This one old man goes out and defeats the enemy. Anyway, that is essentially what is happening here. And that's the essential battle between the Haskalah and seeing that God wins with this one old man, or seeing that God wins with 30 F-35s, with the newest and fanciest airplane. There is a difference. Anyway, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Gideon has this thing, he tests HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he wants to understand the nature of how, whether it's going to be this kind of miracle or this kind. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, go down and you'll see a sign from the enemy that you will win. Gideon goes down and he comes down and he hears two of the soldiers, of the enemy soldiers, talking. And one says, I had a dream yesterday. And in the dream, we won't go into all the details, he had a barley cake that comes in and rolls over and knocks down all of the tents and destroys everything. And the other person says, the dream means that Gideon is going to come and destroy us. There's a couple of things. One, again, this is a Pesach time. Remember, this is Pesach time. The barley, Seor, is brought as a sacrifice at two times. One is that at the Omer, the first of the Omer has two sacrifices, one at the beginning, one at the end of the Omer period. The first is barley. That's one time it's brought. The other time is for Sota, that for a woman who has gotten, who's been placed in a compromising situation after being told don't get into such a situation. She brings a sacrifice and then she's given this water to drink. And the Mefarshim take and make the analogies for both of these cases. That this, in this merit, Gideon was going to win. Also, there are two parts. One is the dream itself, one is the interpretation. We have in these week's parshas a lot of different dreams. The question is, do dreams have a meaning or not?
Didn't Yosef prove they knew?
What?
Didn't Yosef prove they knew?
Maybe yes and maybe not.
Most of them. Wasn't it like most of the dream apart from like one little bit?
Alright, there are many different halacha, and there are many different approaches in Jewish hashkafa and Jewish philosophy regarding dreams. The basic approach is that a dream, Pharaoh's dream may be different. The ones Yosef had may be different. There's some others that may be exceptions. But essentially the dream, it goes according to the interpretation. So that if you have a dream and you interpret it as bad, then the dream might have powers to do things that are bad. If you have the same dream and you interpret it as good, somebody, either you or somebody else interprets it, then the power has to interpret it as for the good. So according to what the Gemara says, the dream will go according to the interpretation. And that the interpretation, therefore, solidifies what the dream is about. again, it's in most Jewish Hashkafa questions, there are a variety of different meanings and different kinds of interpretations that that implies. But the dreams, the meanings of the dreams, aren't necessarily clear. We see with Yosef's dream regarding the people that come, and the interpretation may or may not be clear, as many other things. So there's some people talk about a certain component of prophecy, but most, the basic principle is that dreams are go according to the interpretation. The 300, you know, the supplies, the other people leave their supplies, and they do so willingly. We'll see later on that the people in Parakas, we'll see that the people complain that they weren't allowed to fight. And here Gideon passes it through. But later on with the next Shofet, not the next Shofet, but later on with the Shofet of Yiftach, the people in a fight, people come and complain that they weren't allowed to fight, and there's a war almost that takes place. A war, I guess you would call it. Lots of people were killed because they complained that it wasn't fair that they weren't called. And they didn't come to volunteer. But what happens is Gideon divides his 300 men into three groups of 100. And they go on three sides. They leave the side towards the east open. And each man has a shofar. Each man has a torch that's covered with a pottery pot. What are you, Harris? What?
Clay.
Ceramic clay pot. Yes. It's covered with this, with a pot, so that it can't be seen. And they have a shofar, and the shofar is like the best analogy for those from America would be the bugle for the cavalry charge. Each company has their own bugle. So here each man has his own bugle, his own shofar. And they surround them, and they, 300 men, blow their shofar. Gideon says, when I blow it, and my group, everybody else should blow it. They blow the shofar. They uncover their torch, and they make these loud noises by smashing their clay pots. And the enemy panics, and they start killing each other. And essentially, they destroy them all. And they kill them. Now some of them flee. Gideon pursues them, and we'll see in the next parak some of the problems and some of the halachic implications of that pursuit. He crosses the Jordan River, the Yarden. At that time, the Jordan River was actually there. Now, much of the Jordan River is not there. The reason for that is because it's been dammed up, and the water is left in the Kinneret. Now, when there is water, it's left in the Kinneret for the national water supply. But the Jordan River was a river. It was flowing. He calls out the people to attack those Midianim and Amaleki that are fleeing. He calls to Ephraim. He's from Manasseh. If you look on the map, you see that Ephraim is below. He calls to Ephraim to come out and to attack. And he and his 300 men go after four princes, the rulers. The rulers can be found where? Where is their names? Their names are familiar to you. Does anybody know where their names can be found?
They're right here.
They're right here. What are their names? There's four people.
Oreb.
Zev and Oreb. What? No, Abiezer is a name for Gidon.
Midian,
what?
Oreb and
Zeev. Do we know where else you know these names from? Is any place you know these names from? Tehillim. What's Tehillim? Tehillim that you say every day. Or every other day. Or every day that you're awake, or every school day that you're awake might be the better. The Tehillim that we say. It's Kafalim. Talks about these fights, these battles. The first fight, the first people that are mentioned that were defeated were from Devorah. We have Sisera and Yavin. And then we have the four princes and kings that are here that Gidon fights with. Remember that the Tehillim was written by David. David is a how long after this? Again, if we flip the map over, for those that can flip things over because they have them. You have Gidon. Gidon, it says, is in 4683. Now, this is at the beginning of his period because this is when he fights. So, 4683. Eli rules into 2871. From Eli, if you take a pen and write down afterwards, we have Shmuel, who rules for 40 years. And then we have David, who rules for 30 years, during what she writes the Tehillim. So, how long after this fight does David write that Tehillim? What?
70?
40 and 30, 70? No, but we're up here on this line here by Gidon, Yerubal. 2683. We go down to 2871 and add about 70 years. That's 294, 295, something like that. 295, take away from 2683 to 29 is about
310.
300. No, it's actually about 200 plus. You didn't do the math right, but it's 200. It's about 270 years, 260 years. All right, so they defeat the armies and they kill about 100 and what is it, 120? How many men did they kill? Anyway, I don't remember where how many people. It was about 120, if I'm not mistaken, but I can't find the pasuk right offhand. There now in the parakhas, it continues with Gidon Yuval pursuing them, and he asks for assistance, and he's not given it, and that's the next section.